Well, this illustrates the technique. Yeah.
What happened to the slaves that these people freed?
Yes, now that's another problem on their minds. Of course, they felt a responsibility for them, both individually, and the meeting did both. And they needed help. Of course, they were penniless and uneducated, and there was nothing they could do. What often happened was that they were employed at the same job they'd had as slaves and paid wages. That seemed to me, and received, of course, as employees, the kind of care and interest of interested, not disinterested, but interested employers. That often happened. And many Quakers felt their conscience it was justified by now they were free. There were problems, though, for the Quakers. In many states, a freed slave was the responsibility by law of the man that had freed him. And if he should become a public charge, then the man that had freed him was required by law. This went all the way up to the state of Maine. And a man thought twice before he would be responsible for the expense if the slave got disabled or lazy and became a public charge. This was something they had to take on by law. And they were mostly willing to do it.
How is this different from holding the slave per se? If you have a slave, you have to take care of him.
Yes.
Well, if you
turn
him
loose... Was slavery any better than what they did after they freed him?
No, I mean, why would a Quaker be unwilling to turn a slave loose because of this responsibility? You were responsible...
Well, the same reason I know there are a lot of refugees in Hungary that want to migrate to America, and I'm told, as we are or were a few years ago, that if I would endorse their coming here and say I'd be responsible to the American government for them after they arrive, in case they should be a public charge, well, I have to think about that. Suppose they should be a public charge. I and my children are going, for as long as they live, going to be responsible financially for their support. I might take on one, but when I'm asked to take on a second family, I think about that. It's that natural caution, yes?
I think this is what Danny's saying. It's a different story with a slave, because the Quaker was already responsible for taking care of the slave while he was a slave.
Yeah, but
so there's no change in the condition.
He could get work out of it. He was his master and could use every form of pressure up to killing him, try to get work out of him. That would be the difference. But now the slave's a free man. He can offer him a job and pay him. But if the slave's a shiftless fellow, and after all, their background didn't train them for trips to the store. These refugees that come from Europe are a lottery. Some of them are fine. We took on two families and never paid a cent on them many years ago. They're very prosperous, but that was the chance. Another family, one of the meetings I knew, took on a family, and the father had a complex and committed suicide. And here was his wife and four small children, ultimately five small children. The meeting was responsible for that, because they signed a statement. Worse than that, some states have laws forbidding the freeing of a slave. North Carolina, particularly. And the Quakers tried again and again to get that law changed, and they didn't succeed. And finally, they did a rather peculiar thing. The members of the meeting who wanted to free their slaves, and of course the meeting was doing everything it could to persuade them, deeded the slave to the trustees of the meeting. And nominally, they weren't freed. Actually, they were treated as free. And no individual Quaker owned a slave in North Carolina, but the meeting owned a great lot of them, one of the biggest slave owners for the time being. But of course, you know, the trustees appointed for this purpose would do everything except holding the ownership papers would treat them as free. These slaves now would be free. They could go out, and although they were slaves of the meeting, they could work for an employer, and the employer would pay the meeting. When you rented a slave to somebody, the employer would pay the meeting the day's wage, and then the meeting would pay back, give it right back to the slave. Well, this is one of the peculiar situations. This wasn't characteristic, but I think you see that if you have a delicate conscience, you sometimes can find ways of circumventing the law. And it was many years afterwards that the law. In fact, it was long after the Civil War that some of the southern states, just before the Civil War, that one of the southern states repealed a law, making it wrong to make it illegal to free a slave. Now, in England, when they abolished slavery, recognizing that they were expropriating private property by government, same kind of thing that happens when the state wants to build a road through my farm and just takes it. They pay me for the land they've taken, don't they? This is the usual way in which a state that interferes with private property, and the slaves were the private property, and therefore England, when it freed the slaves, paid the masters the market price of the slave. The Quakers began to wonder whether, even after they'd freed the slave, they didn't owe the slaves some back pay. And when they freed the slave, many of them calculated a reasonable wage for all the years since that slave had worked, say, since he was 21 years old, and paid the slave that much money, or at least kept it in bank for him to his account, and he could draw it. Curious, when a man's been doing what's wrong and the government stops him, is it the government's business to pay him for taking the slave, or is it the man's business to pay the slave? These are two different, quite different forms of compensation, you see. May I say a word now about the the things that held the Friends up even during this later period? There was the problem of how to persuade the members of the meeting to get rid of the slave. I already did illustrate that. If some of the some of the members of the meeting owned slaves and others didn't approve of it, then you're in an awkward situation. And the unity and friendliness of the meeting is a very important thing to preserve. That's one reason they went so slowly. You know, the theory of a friend meeting for business is you proceed only after everybody's had a chance to express opinion, and you don't just outvote people and ruthlessly go ahead over a minority. They didn't do that. But there was still danger of friction in the meeting. And as time went on, the people became more radical in their advocacy of liberation, abolition, carrying the campaign outside the meeting and into other groups. And other people in the meeting thought they were a little radical about it. I guess you can only think of a few modern problems, racial or international, where you'd expect a meeting not to agree on just how far you want to go. There are these awfully radical people who want to do something right now. And other people in the meeting think we can wait. Well, this was a problem. Actually, there were some separations, splits, in the local meetings. And the anti-slavery, the radical anti-slavery people formed a new organization. And the rather more conservative people looked on them as And of course, the radical people that spit off on this would very soon get other radical ideals, make them even more unwelcome to the conservative body of the meeting. Because if you get radical ideas about slavery, you may get very radical ideas about war, about women's rights, and so on. One radical view leads to another. You may get very radical views about the conduct of friends' meetings. I mean about how much authority there should be every man. Why have any book of discipline? Why have any monthly and quarterly meeting? Why not let each individual do as he pleases? These radical anti-slavery people began raising a lot of extreme problems. One thing that bothered the friends, you'd be surprised at this perhaps, was that they'd become so detached from the rest of society and retained their old-fashioned hostility to the established church, and particularly their criticism of paid preachers, that when they thought of joining those that were against slavery with the people, especially in the North here, where there were many sympathetic people, you know a lot of how much of New England was anti-slavery long before the Civil War, and they thought of joining hands with them, then the question was, should anti-slavery Quakers join with anti-slavery non-Quakers in organizing anti-slavery meetings, societies, campaigns, and so on? And a lot of the friends were so conservative, they said, we can't have anything to do with these non-Quakers. They're right about slavery, but they're wrong about some other things. And therefore, we advise friends, if they're going to work against slavery, to keep within our own borders. I've heard people say today, why do modern Quakers join other peace advocates? These various interdenominational or general peace crusades. Why the Society of Friends is a peace society? Why not just stay and work inside of that? Well, that's what they've said about slavery. We are an anti-slavery group. If we want to help, why, we can do it inside our own borders.